Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Secular Foxhole Podcast. Today, Martin and I are very pleased to have Carrie McDonald with us. She's a senior education fellow at the Foundation for Economic Education and the author of Unschooled, Raising Curious, Well-Educated Children Outside the Conventional Classroom. Carrie, nice to have you. How are you?
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, one of the things that we do here at the Secular Foxhole, we are advocates of the separation of state and religion, and also the separation of state and education.
Wonderful.
You have an interesting, sort of an interesting segue into homeschooling. You were doing your master's work at Harvard, and you, I don't recall, were you babysitting someone or were you just...
No, I was an economics major as an undergraduate in the late 1990s and became increasingly interested in education and education policy from passion for economics. And really at that point, starting to see that, you know, we had this sort of monopoly run system of government schooling and very limited choices for families in the education sector compared to all of the other aspects of our lives. And I just found that really curious. So I began to take some more education classes as an undergrad and had a chance to do an independent research project on homeschooling. And I didn't know anything about homeschooling. This, again, was the late 1990s. Homeschooling had just become legally recognized in the U.S. a few years prior by the mid-1990s. So it was still rather marginal at the time. In 1998 was the first year that the U.S. Department of Education began tracking homeschoolers. They counted 850,000 at that point. So, you know, still something kind of on the fringes and not really the mainstream option that it's become. But when I was able to shadow this homeschooling family as part of this research project, I was just completely captivated by this whole idea of learning outside of conventional schooling and following a child's interests and connecting them to resources in their larger communities and seeing kind of the authentic socialization that occurs when young people are immersed in their people, in the people, places, and things of their community, as opposed to sort of this false socialization that we see in conventional schooling. And that same semester, I was doing a student teaching practicum at a local public elementary school and really was able to see the contrast up close between these kinds of, you know, two ways of learning. And I had gone to public schools for K-12 and never really thought much of it. And I think most of us, you know, wouldn't think much of it. But then seeing another way of being educated in a way that I thought was even more superior, you know, really piqued my interest. And then that's when I ended up going to graduate school in education policy at Harvard, became really interested in and involved in the school choice movement. Ultimately, you know, a decade later, when I had kids decided and looking at education options for them, my husband and I decided that we would homeschool them. We live in Boston, Massachusetts, actually in Cambridge, where there's just so many resources for homeschoolers. So it was the right step for us.
Yeah, well, one of my pet peeves is this false idea that parents won't homeschool their kids because they won't get enough socialization. And I just think that's totally wrong. Do you agree with that or?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm sort of ashamed to admit that when I first went into this family's home to shadow them, my first question was, what about socialization? And now, of course, on the receiving end of that, I cringe because it's sort of a knee-jerk question because we've been, I think, all conditioned to believe that the only way you can be socialized is in a kind of conventional school environment. And when we really start thinking about it a little more critically, we realize, I think, that what we're asking are kids being social? You know, are they interacting with peers and mentors? Are they getting exposed to all kinds of different ideas and viewpoints? And of course, we're much able to see that occur authentically in kind of these larger communities and with, you know, kind of interest-based learning and the mentors and classes and activities in the homeschooling world, more so perhaps than in conventional schooling environment where you have an age-segregated group of students, a static handful of teachers, a standardized curriculum, go with the same building and the same people kind of every day for 10 months of the year. So yeah, when you really start thinking about it, I think homeschoolers stand out. And I'll just give kind of one a bit of research that sort of backs that up. Daniel Hamlin is a professor at the University of Oklahoma who's done a lot of research on homeschoolers. And he published a piece in 2019 looking at what he called cultural capital of homeschoolers compared to public school students. And he found that homeschoolers were much more likely, twice as likely, in fact, than their public school peers to go to a library, go to a museum, go to cultural events, musical events, historic sites, be really connected and embedded within their communities, much more so than students who attended public schools.
Is that article or essay online? Or
You should be able to Google Daniel Hamlin, University of Oklahoma, and homeschool research. It was an academic paper published in a journal.
Okay, good. One of the interesting articles I came across in preparing for this interview was that this disaster called COVID, one of the great things that has come out of it is that more parents are pulling their children out of public schools because there's so many horror stories about teachers' unions forcing their will on the, you know, that their particular school district, and more and more parents are just getting fed up with it. And even I saw this article where till 2019, 3% of public and private school teachers were actually homeschooling their children. As of when I read this article, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, that figure has jumped to 11% of public and private school teachers are now homeschooling their children, which I think is fantastic, because if there's anything that needs to be chipped away at, it's the education bureaucracy. And again, my personal view of that. Now, you also, I think you started or head an organization called the Alliance for Self-Education. Can you tell me about that?
So I was involved with the founding of that. I was a founding board member. That organization has since evolved. I'm no longer connected to it, but it was originally designed along with Peter Gray and some others. Peter Gray is a psychology professor at Boston College who wrote the book Free to Learn, is a huge advocate for unschooling and self-directed education. And he wrote the foreword to my Unschooled book. So really championing these ideas of non-coercive learning and education outside of a conventional classroom that isn't replicating school at home, isn't just sort of changing the location of education from a school classroom to a living room or a kitchen, but actually, you know, challenging the whole idea of coercion and compulsion in education and recognizing that, you know, humans are innately designed to learn and discover and explore and synthesize the world around them. And young children show this exuberance for learning and for creativity and really a zest for discovery and imagination. And what happens is we end up stifling those sort of natural drives for learning when a child goes to school and learns that conformity is valued over creativity and obedience is valued over originality. And so all of that kind of childhood exuberance doesn't just magically disappear, sort of crushed out of young people as they move through the conveyor belt of conventional schooling. And I'll just mention, because you kind of said how there's been this increase in homeschooling, and we can touch on some of the data regarding that over the past 18 months. So
please, yes.
My book Unschooled that came out, was published in the spring of 2019, did well, but actually had an even more successful year in 2020 up till present, as so many more families at least considered pulling their kids out of school for homeschooling. It became more sort of a reasonable thing to do. And in fact, many families did it. So the U.S. Census Bureau found the homeschooling rate had doubled in 2020 alone, from about 5% in the spring of 2020. This would be independent homeschoolers, of parents who've unenrolled their kids from a district school for independent homeschooling, more than doubled to more than 11% in the fall of 2020. And that represents more than tripling of the homeschool population from pre-pandemic levels, where there was just about 3.5% of the overall K-12 school age population was homeschooled. Now over 11%. That equates to over 5 million students now in the U.S. And what the Census Bureau found really interestingly was that the biggest driver of this increase in homeschooling in 2020 was Black families, Black homeschoolers, that experienced a fivefold increase in homeschooling rates from pre-pandemic levels, so that now about 16% or a little over 16% of the homeschool population are Black homeschoolers. And that's an overrepresentation in the homeschool community compared to Black student representation in the overall K to 12 school age population.
Well, I think I saw a similar article where they mentioned both Black and Hispanic. Hispanic homeschooling is on the rise as well. So,
yeah, Hispanic homeschoolers were always right aligned with their representation in the larger K to 12 school population. Right around one quarter of the homeschool population is Hispanic, and that held true pre-pandemic as well. For Black homeschoolers, it lagged a little bit in the homeschool community, and now it's overrepresented. So it's nice to see, you know, the trend certainly has been over the past decade that the homeschool population is much more reflective of the U.S. population more generally, demographically, geographically, socioeconomically, ideologically, okay, and so on. And now it's becoming even more clear.
You just segued into my next question is, historically, homeschooling has been the province of Christians. Is that now spread to more secular areas, or do you have any data on that?
You're reading my mind now. playing the devil's advocate here.
Sure, yeah.
Coming from Europe, and now I interrupted you. But you
know, go ahead.
You have that issue. Of course, it's up to the parents, but they could teach something about, like, creationism and so on. But in Europe and others, you believe in the state as religion. But please continue, Carrie.
Yeah, so I go through the history of the modern homeschooling movement in my book, Unschooled. And I talk about the fact that the modern homeschooling movement really began on the political left in the late 1960s and early 1970s. It was sort of these hippies, anti-institutional, anti-establishment individuals and groups that really were fighting against sort of authoritarianism in all ways, including education. So it began on the left. And then you're right, it grew through conservative Christian circles in the 1980s and early 1990s.
Sure,
but then by about 2012, the U.S. Department of Education found that religious motivations weren't kind of the top factor in why families were choosing to homeschool. In fact, the number one motivator for homeschooling families is concern about the environment of other schools, including safety, drugs, and negative peer pressure, followed by a desire for academic excellence. And in fact, I believe that the U.S. Department of Education data from 2016, the most recent data we have, shows that only about 16% of homeschoolers in the U.S. are choosing to homeschool for religious reasons. So again, much more reflective of kind of the overall U.S. population in terms of education choices. And in fact, some of the largest growth in homeschooling is occurring in urban secular communities.
I see. I was just about, again, to say your most recent article, you mentioned Los Angeles, Chicago, and Seattle are among the cities that public school enrollment is plummeting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so that's another sort of interesting data point. You know, if you had asked me, and I was asked this in the kind of late spring, oh, what do I think for predictions for the fall of this year? You know, will homeschooling dip? Will parents send their kids back to the classroom? And I said, yeah, you know, I think that there will be this decline in homeschooling, that now that most classrooms will be open for full-time in-person learning, families will decide to go back to kind of a conventional classroom, even though I said, you know, we'll still have some elevated levels. I felt like there would be a dip. And I'm glad to say I've really been proven wrong, that in fact, in some areas, like you mentioned, my most recent article, the exodus from public schools is actually higher this year than last. Los Angeles is a perfect example. They lost 4.76% of their public school students in the previous academic year, and they lost another 6% this academic year. Similar trend in Chicago and Seattle and other smaller, you know, cities as well. That is also poking holes in the funding arrangements. So there was a bit of a funding freeze for schools last year when they lost enrollment. Funding didn't diminish, but that kind of reprieve has been relinquished now. And so districts are starting to see that they are losing funding because they're losing students and taxpayers don't want to fund more empty schools.
That's a yes. Yes. I mean, and I've noticed this for decades. I guess city administrators, city officials, state officials, obviously federal bureaucrats, they keep clamoring for more money for education. Yet the results are keep getting more and more dismal. So somebody somewhere, somebody has to pull the pin out of the, or put a pin in the balloon or whatever you want to call it to burst that bubble.
I think that's what we're starting to see. I mean, I think as more parents realize that they're empowered to leave an assigned district school, they are doing that. You know, I think in the past it was sort of like, oh, well, everyone sends their kids to this government assigned school. And so we'll just do that. And what the COVID response has done over the past year and a half is really put parents back in the driver's seat, make them kind of question what it is they're doing in terms of education, get a close up glimpse of their kids' classrooms through Zoom school. And a lot of what they saw, they didn't like. So they felt re-empowered. They pulled their kids out for homeschooling or for private schools. In Chicago, for example, that I mentioned, has seen a further public school enrollment decline this fall. There's been an associated increase in Catholic school enrollment, up 6.5% in the city. So parents are really voting with their feet. And we're also seeing along the lines of expanding parental choice in education, record high support for school choice policies that enable education funding to follow the students as opposed to being funneled into these bureaucratic school systems. And so the most recent surveys done by Real Clear Research found that nearly 3/4 of U.S. taxpayers now support school choice policies. And in fact, about 24 states have passed or expanded school choice legislation that allows for this kind of decentralization of education funding.
That's great. Both the left and the right are like busy rewriting American history. What do you think of this 1619 project?
So interestingly enough, when in the fall of 2020, so I believe it was last October, then President Trump had put forth his call for mandatory patriotic education in U.S. public schools and what he called the 1776 Commission. And I wrote an article then for fee.org that said, if you don't want a Biden 1619 Commission, and this was before the election, you should oppose Trump's 1776 Commission. And I went through all of the reasons why. The primary reason being, of course, that there is no constitutional role for federal government in education. It is a state and local issue. So the federal government should not be involved in education policy. The U.S. Department of Education itself is unconstitutional. And when we start having education policy trickle down at the federal level, it really limits choice for families. Now we have sort of this nationalized curriculum or nationalized education focus that really prevents sort of this federalism vision that the founders had of having individual states and communities decide what they wanted their policies to be. And that, again, gives families so many more options. If you don't like your state or local education policies, you have much more flexibility and to move or to voice your concerns than you do if this is all coming down at the federal level.
I keep wondering, I wish I had a sound effects machine where I could just hit the applause. I just came across another one of your articles where you referred to John Locke, Locke versus Lockdown. Can you delve into that a little bit for us?
Yes. In my Unschooled book, I trace sort of the philosophical origins of this idea of non-coercive learning and self-directed education all the way back to the Enlightenment and the views of John Locke, who back in 1693 wrote a wonderful treatise on education. And he really, at the time, we would think of it today as him being an advocate for sort of gentle parenting and self-directed learning. You know, he talked about not using force in education, that a child will go much more willingly to their studies if they're not forced into doing that and sort of supporting their environment. So I have a special place for John Locke, and then kind of revisiting that in light of the authoritarianism over the past 18 months with COVID policies. And, you know, one of my favorite quotes that I don't include in the Unschooled book, but that I've since come to quote quite a bit, is from a letter that John Locke wrote in 1689, where he says, quote, "It is one thing to persuade, another to command, one thing to press with arguments, another with penalties." And I think that we've sort of lost sight of his mm-hmm. vision over the past 18 months, that we are instead embracing coercion over persuasion and embracing penalties over arguments and not tolerating differences of opinion. And so this piece was really just reminding us of sort of these Enlightenment values that have led to so much progress and prosperity and that we seem to be turning our backs towards.
Right. I think one of my favorite commentators said it this way. He said, or I'll paraphrase, he said, "Why are we embracing China's answer to COVID mm-hmm. instead of America's answer to COVID," which means freedom.
Exactly. And another case, again, for federalism, whether it's in COVID policy or education, is allow individual states to be these incubators of experimentation, and it gives people a lot more flexibility of where they choose to live.
Yeah, what is going on in Australia and New Zealand?
East state, right? Yeah.
That's scary.
It is. Scary. And I think that it's another opportunity to, you know, talk to our kids about some of these ideas of freedom over force and voluntarism over coercion, and help them to recognize that what's happened in terms of COVID policy over the past year has resulted in kind of ballooning government and centralization of power. And that has tremendous negative consequences on the individual lives and freedom of people and communities and small businesses.
I subscribe to a education newsletter called Dumb and Dumber Professor Brad Thompson.
Right.
Are you familiar with that?
Yes, and he is expanding to even publish even more great content on education. So, yeah, highly recommend his work.
Yeah, let me read just a couple of headlines in his most recent one. Let's see. He did mention the story from the Washington Times about the problem with public schools. Taxpayer monies continue to increase, but not our children's quality of education, which we talked about. Here's what's happening at James Madison University, ladies and gentlemen. University says overweight people are, quote, oppressed, victims of white supremacy, unquote. A Stanford professor says whiteness explains parents' opposition to school mask mandates. These things, they're aiding and abetting, hopefully, their own demise, if you will, driving more and more people to examine what, you know, they're sending their kids to. And the homeschool, I think the homeschool movement is too big now to turn back. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that a lot of these school level policies, district policies, whether they're COVID policies or they're more these curriculum focus on, you know, identity politics and so on, are really turning off a lot of families. And now they realize they have the power of exit, that they can leave and find some other really great opportunities. So my most recent ebook, published at Fee, that you can just download from my website at fee.org/carry. It's free, and it's the 2021 Curious Parents Guide to Education Options that really looks into these kind of affordable and accessible alternatives to conventional schooling. And, you know, I dive into some of the themes that I obviously expand on in the Unschooled book, but this idea that homeschooling is really the legal lever to bypass or challenge compulsory schooling statutes at the state level and really encourage education, innovation, and entrepreneurship. And we've seen quite a bit of that over the past 18 months. I think, for example, of the pandemic pods that began sprouting really in the last spring, last summer of 2020, as parents realized that schools were going to be closed for in-person learning and their kids hadn't had any kind of social interaction in several months. They realized they needed to take matters into their own hands. And so they created these small learning pods, often with other families, either from their children's school or neighborhood. and we're able to have small groups, often of multi-age students, kind of replicating this one-room schoolhouse model, and either taking turns in different families' homes throughout the week or choosing one set location. And in many cases, hiring an educator or college student or someone to facilitate a curriculum, or parents taking turns doing that as well. And it really is sort of this modern twist, not only kind of the time-honored homeschool co-op model that has been serving homeschoolers for quite a long time, but also really merges with the burgeoning microschool movement that had been gaining in popularity prior to the pandemic and continues to really accelerate, where we do have this set kind of more decentralized, often home-based model that involves bringing in other educators to connect with multi-age groups of students in private homes or small commercial spaces. And so we've seen quite a bit of that, you know, occurring over the last 18 months. I've written about that quite a bit at my Forbes column, most recently talking about some of these alternatives that are gaining some traction. I think of a company called GetSchoolhouse.com. It's really a pod enabler. They connect families who are interested in creating one of these pandemic pods or learning pods with a certified teacher. And they just raised more than $8 million in venture capital funding this past spring. So there's a lot of opportunity there for education, entrepreneurship, and innovation under the kind of homeschooling umbrella.
That's great.
That sounds That's like great. A good now, idea. How again, can you export this?
Yeah, you know, I don't know as much, you know, I focus much more on domestic education than globally, but I'm hoping that it can be exported. Yes, that education, innovation, entrepreneurship will continue to expand. There's another company that's doing incredibly well, like many rounds of venture capital funding in, called outschool.com, and they are a much more global company that allows for kind of individual live Zoom-based classes on all sorts of topics, then teachers just sign up to teach classes that they're interested in, or anybody who considers themselves an educator can create an account as an educator and offer classes. And again, another real opportunity to tap into people's expertise and talents in a much more decentralized way. And they're doing really, really well, again, I think accelerated by the pandemic, and they have much more global reach. So I think it's a good indicator that a lot of these new companies and startups and innovations will be able to take hold worldwide.
Sounds like a good idea. Blair, it could be like inspired by my Twitter account, Lyceum Peripatos.
Yeah.
You go to the ancient Greece and learn how you met and talked with teachers and students and have a conversation, discourse, even a debate, and then learn from that. So I think that's a great idea to hear about these new ways of teaching and education. So thanks for that.
Yeah, I think it's really been a time for disruptive innovation in education, long time coming. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's something mm-hmm. I've been writing about for years, even before the pandemic, but I think it took this external force to really shake things up and make sure that now parents realize they have more choices, make sure they demand more choices, entrepreneurs stepping up to provide those choices, and kind of the bureaucratic institutions losing power.
Yeah, again, I was going to say, you hear Bernie Sanders and I'm assuming Joe Biden as well, or mostly Democrats, say that, you know, okay, let's make education free for everybody. Or let's...
There's that free word.
Yes, exactly. Again, it's another, I won't say last ditch attempt, because they'll probably never stop trying to subvert, you know, the homeschool movement with these kinds of offers, if you will, this kind of bribery is what I'll call it. What do you think of that? Yeah. Do you see any traction in these bills that are, you know, free preschool for everybody, free college for everybody?
It's hard to compete with free, quote unquote, free. And, you know, that is really what happened at the dawn of the compulsory schooling movement in the mid-19th century, you know, here in the U.S., where, you know, prior to the passage of the country's first compulsory schooling statute here in Massachusetts, leading the way in compulsion in 1852, and then replicated nationwide, you know, there was a wide assortment of education options for families that included public schools. So there are since the 1600s had been legislation in place to require cities and towns of a certain size to open and operate a public school or hire a teacher for these different communities. But the compulsion was on the cities and towns. And it wasn't until the 19th century that that compulsion shifted to families to be forced to send their children to a public school. And what we found, in fact, I talk about this a little bit in my unschooled book and in some of my articles, the historian David Nassau wrote in his book, Schooled to Order, that the number of private schools in Massachusetts dropped from about 1,300, a little over 1,300 private schools in 1840 to only 350 by 1880. And again, a lot of this was because now parents were being, you know, having to pay twice for compulsory taxation to fund these public schools, as well as then paying tuition to send their kids to private schools. And so they were diminished. And now we see the same trend happening, of course, with the push nationally and at the state and local levels for universal pre-K and public preschool programs that are pushing out small, often women-owned, often minority-owned private daycare and preschool programs because it's just hard for them to compete with free.
Yes, but they claim to, you know, help they to be for the poor and for the minorities and this, that, and the other. You know, so that's there's the con right there. As we head towards our wrap up, I came across this great article by you on how three women sought to sway Americans away from socialism. And you mentioned Rose Wilder Lane, Isabel Patterson, and Ayn Rand. Can you delve a little bit into those three ladies for us?
Yeah. So this was an article I wrote earlier this spring. You know, I'm always interested in elevating voices of liberty. And in this case, it was Women's History Month, which seems like a good time to capitalize on what the role of women has been in the liberty movement. It's really interesting to kind of dig into the lives of these women. They were friendly acquaintances. They, you know, were certainly in the same writing circles. Rose Wilder Lane was the daughter of Laura Ingalls Wilder from Little House Books. And it's speculated that Rose really helped Laura to write and commercialize those books and make them into kind of this mainstay of American history that they've become and a literature. But she was, you know, a vocal critic of Roosevelt's New Deal, of Social Security, of other government programs that, you know, she really felt disempowered individuals and gave greater authority to the state. She was very close with Isabel Patterson, and Isabel Patterson was also a prolific writer. She wrote a prominent column for the New York Herald Tribune, where she wrote for about 25 years, emphasizing libertarian themes. She was opposed to prohibition, the military draft, government schooling, crony capitalism. She wrote the book The God and the Machine, which was really a treatise on freedom. And then Ayn Rand, of course, I'm sure most of us know, was born and grew up in Soviet Russia and then emigrated here and of course wrote her magnum opus, Atlas Shrugged, but prior to that, The Fountainhead, Anthem, and We the Living, as well as several nonfiction books, and was a champion of capitalism and individual freedom. And they all had sort of connection to Leonard Reed, who was the founder of FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education, where I am, which is the country's oldest libertarian think tank that was founded by Reed in 1946.
Well, should we include you in that pantheon?
Not yet. I have a lot of work to do to step up into their shoes.
He wrote a powerful essay about the pencil and the power of that back in the day.
I Pencil, that's right. Yes. It's his beautiful essay on spontaneous order and the decentralization of the market, and the fact that the magic of the market enables people who don't know each other, who may not even speak the same language, to work together cooperatively to satisfy, you know, needs and demand. And I think, again, a lesson as we see supply chain disruptions getting worse, it's a reminder that the centralization of power and interference, government interference in the market really prevents this kind of voluntary exchange of goods and services among cooperative people.
Free minds and free markets.
That's right. That's correct. Carrie, do you plan on, are you working on another book, or do you plan on expanding your ebook into a new book, or do you have any thoughts on that?
That's a good question. Yeah, I have the ebook that just came out. So I think I'll try to put out some ebooks more frequently. Those are easier to get out and I think can be more timely. I just recorded the audio book version of the ebook. So that will be great. Again, free for fee.org. readers and listeners. And, you know, mostly I'm just really interested now in elevating the stories of education entrepreneurs who are creating new free market solutions for families. So I try to do that a lot in my Forbes.com column, and that gets republished at fee.org as well, to really spotlight some of these, you know, bold and visionary entrepreneurs and educators who are really trying to remake the education landscape.
That's great. That's great. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking to Carrie McDonald, homeschooling advocate and author of Unschooled. Carrie, where can we find you on the web?
Yeah, so please visit me at fee.org/Carrie, K-E-R-R-Y. There you can see links to all of my social media accounts. You can send me an email. You can see all of my recent articles, links to my books, as well as sign up for my weekly email newsletter.
Martin, do you have anything to add?
No, thanks. Thanks for your time, Carrie. It was an interesting conversation, and we'll include this in the show notes, and we'll talk to you soon again, I think.
Oh, that would be great. It's been wonderful being with you.
Well, again, we've talked to Carrie McDonald. Carrie, thanks for... I normally end the show with thanks for manning the foxhole with us. I hope you're not offended by that.
Not at all. It's great to be here.
Carrie, thank you so much.
Thanks again. Take care.
Bye-bye.